So I'm going to break this talk into two steps. I'm going to tell you about who we are. And the main message there is that relative to some of the groups you've seen before, is that we're much newer to Winston. And so we're very much in building mode. And then I'll tell you some highlights about what we do, and that will involve a little bit of context about what the field is doing. And the main difference there is that a large part of the field is driven by experimental events, and that's been a deliberate choice of PI to be in that part of particle physics, given where we are in the history of particle physics. And so I'll need to set some context as to what's going on there. And then I'll conclude with a little bit of a kind of a picture of where we're going to go. So what about the group? So the group started off some time ago. Maxime and I were the only ones for a while. We're both associates. We started in 2004 and have been renewed once. But then we started really building in 2008 with the hiring of our first two postdocs, Brian and Michael. And we have a senior research affiliate as well, John Muffin. We've hired two more postdocs the following year. And then we started hiring faculty just last year with Philip and Natalia, who joined us. And then the next year, we just recently have hired Itai Yavin, who's also an associate at McMaster. And we've had the first turnover in our postdoc population, in that both Michael and Brian have moved on to Chicago and CERN. We have two new ones joining us whose pictures aren't on the web, and so I just Googled. I don't have a fascination with muscled men. It's just that's the picture I found. you Google Carlos and Hypen, that's what you get. So and then we also, of course, have many distinguished research chairs. I just moved the two of them over there like I did before. It's not new people. Not a statement about our DRCs.
I'm almost
afraid. this is all the pictures so far. So we have many DRCs that overlap us, and we have right now a visiting fellow, Matt Strassler, who overlaps very much the interests of many of us, but specifically Itai, Natalia, and Philip. So I think the summary here is that it's a building group. It's acquiring a critical mass, and the emphasis of the research interests of these people that have been hired, you'll see more recently, is largely on the phenomenological side of particle physics. You know, as you know, particle physics is trying to understand the laws of nature and the constituents of nature at the frontiers of where you can measure it. And that divides into a theoretical side, which runs all the way over to string theory and quantum gravity and things, and there's an experimental side, which can get right down into being difficult to distinguish from the experimentalists themselves. And our growth is in the experimental side. And what's satisfying about these last hires is that they have also had offers at places like Princeton, and we're successfully luring top people from top places to come here, which is a good sign. So I think the slope is right, is the message that I'd like you to get from this. Some stats about what we've been doing. We've been writing numbers of papers, many of which, or some of which, have been high impact, and I'll tell you more about those in a second. We're invited to evidence of impact is invitations to give plenary talks at various places, and we do that a lot. We've organized a variety of meetings here, and they've been very successful, and we get a good, we actually have a problem with the budget people, because we get more of the big name people than we're planning on when we budget it, and so we tend to stretch the budgets a little bit because of that. One of the new initiatives in this line has been the PI LHC days. There's a large ATLAS contingent in the immediate vicinity, and it's important for the experimental side of particle physics to be in touch with what's going on. And so we've organized every 6 months a meeting in the area, half the time here, half the time at a university nearby, to directly bring in contact between the theorists and the experimental program as the LHC has been ramping up. We're well-funded by NSERC, and of course the younger members are just starting that process, but everything looks good from the track record we have. There's been a number of awards that the group has won, and we're involved also in outreach. This is particularly with the LHC, a prime time for outreach, and what's nice about the people in the group is that they don't regard that as a burden. It's a lot of activity there, which is very satisfying. Now, we also interact a lot with the rest of PI, and so if this is kind of a cartoon of that interaction, most of the groups really have some overlap, and some of the specific fields that have been worked on are in those circles, if you want to ask about them. I'm not going to talk about all of them, or some of them I will talk about, but I won't talk about most. The context here, I think, is the person who summed up this the best was we were having a discussion about dark matter once at an outreach thing, and one of the postdocs from one of the other areas said, well, we should first discuss about what's the likelihood of the dark matter problem being solved by a particle physics explanation as opposed to something else. And I remember thinking, it's going to be solved by a particle physics explanation because whatever the explanation is, we're going to make that particle physics. And so there's a sense in which we think of the whole PI is all particle physicists, and they're just working on specific areas of it, and we'll take our inspirations wherever we can find them. So now let me talk more in detail about the research program. And so here's the context part. So there's really, the goal is to understand the laws of nature at the TeV-ish scales in energy, which is the frontier of experiment. And there's several ways to get information about that, which have traditionally been used. And the main message of the next few slides will be that we're mining all those ways, and I think successfully. And so, of course, the main way, the bread and butter way, is the collider way, where you build a machine that produces particles at those energies, and you make the collisions, and you see what's there. And that's the bread and butter way because you really are going to see what's there, and you have control over the process of producing those things. But there are other ways to kind of more indirectly try and access that energy, those energies. And one of them is the precision frontier, where you look at very rare processes. And that might be things like solar neutrinos, and very rare reactions coming from the sun, where you're looking at the detailed reaction rates that are measured on Earth. Tests of conservation laws like CP or CPT or lepton number conservation or baryon number conservation, those kind of things. You know, should you see a violation of those things, things that are forbidden by the standard model of particle physics, which is the essentially the summary of what we know works well in experiments, then you know you've seen something important. The risk here, this is kind of a cheaper but riskier operation. You know, most of these kinds of tests don't find something different from what the standard model produces or predicts, and so you end up measuring zero very accurately. But if you see something different from what the standard model predicts, then you see something that you've learned a lot at that point. And so there's a kind of a complementary line of research there. Cosmology and astrophysics is similar in that it's something which is often, you have less control over how things are, what's going into the, you're not doing experiments, you're observing things. But things like inflation, Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the cosmic microwave background, large scale structure, dark matter and dark energy, what are they? All those things have particle physics implications, and they all say something. They sometimes access energies higher than we can reach on Earth, and so there's information there to be mined. And then there's particularly here, the theoretical constraint. We're not working in a vacuum. The picture that we have of particle physics and the standard model in particular is that it's the low energy limit of something more fundamental. And there's a very precise way in which that's meant as an effective field theory. And there's evidence for that being true, in that there's content in the statement that you're the low energy limit of something. And so the guidance that comes from that statement provides some sort of a constraint onto the speculations you make to describe the experiments. And the idea of this line of approach is to get ahead of the curve rather than being reactive to the experiments, predict the kinds of things that the experiments can be looking for, and give yourself a sense as to what the options are when you're comparing with what is actually seen when the experiments are run. So, most recently, those four programs have been, there's been a lot of action in those areas. So in the first one, of course, the big one is the LHC is ramped up. They broke it when they started it, but it's been restarted and it's working extremely well. And it's working much better than you would have expected. What the experimentalists say that sometimes it's hard to get motivated to write a bound on supersymmetric particles not being there, because you know that the data they collect in the time they're writing that paper will make the bound obsolete. And so they're really collecting a lot of data, and it's really a great time for collider physics. At the same time, the Tevatron is winding down, which is the competitor experiment with lower energies, but previously the highest energy experiments in Fermilab. And there are astrophysical experiments and neutrino experiments that are also coming online and have things to say. Now, there's always, at any given time, anomalies. And there's a certain amount of ambulance chasing that goes on in trying to understand the anomalies. And it's not senseless ambulance chasing in the sense that you're always interested to know what kinds of things, what a theorist can do for an anomaly. What experimentalists can do for anomalies is tell you whether or not they've really accurately assessed their errors and is there really an experimental problem. But what a theorist can do is to ask, are the things you're seeing fitting in with the picture we have? And if it's not, then that makes it less likely makes it more likely that it's an experimental problem, or you're going to learn an awful lot if it's not an experimental problem. But kind of having an assessment as to how likely various developments are in a theoretical context is very useful. And it's instructive to the theorists that do it, of course. And of course, there's also big unsolved problems. We believe that the mass for all particles, elementary particles, come from an ordering of the vacuum, electric weak ordering. And we don't know what the dark matter and dark energy are. And those are all up for grabs. And so those are certainly driving how you think about many of the other problems that you look at. And I want to, so when I show you the highlights, I want to, what I'm doing here is emphasizing that that there will be highlights in all these categories. So these are, from the point of view of ambulance chasing, these are kind of the anomalies that have been around in the last few years. There's anomalies in dark matter. A lot of them have been associated with dark matter, but there's been some neutrino anomalies, and there's funny things going on at the frontier of precision measurements of the muon dipole, or the electric dipole moments, or magnetic dipole moments. And there's funny things that are going on for nucleosynthesis. But the big message is the one on the bottom here about the LHC working well, and it's really going to be the main line of development. Okay, so what are the highlights? I'm going to talk about four specific ones. Dark matter and dark forces, which has been that's had a big splash in the particle physics community, and has its provenance largely comes from here. There's no-nonsense approaches to various kinds of collider physics, the Tevatron anomalies. As things ramp down, they tend to find odd things more. And there has been a number of Tevatron that have been approached, as well as approaches to LHC physics. I'll briefly talk about precision cosmology. Specifically, it says inflation and nucleosynthesis, but I forgot to change that slide. It's going to be nucleosynthesis. And then I'll talk about an example of the approach driven from the theoretical side, and as opposed to reacting to an experimental development. So let me start with the dark matter and dark forces. So many of you have probably seen this before. There was a lot of it. The two things came together to make this a big development in particle physics. One was the experimental development, and that was that the measurements of antiparticles in space gave funny answers. And the Pamela experiment was the classical example. So here's showing you the positrons as a function of energy, and this is kind of the example of the worst fit you've ever seen in your life. This is the data, and this is the theory. You know, we laugh at astronomers for taking a big spread of particles and putting a straight line through it, and so here what happened was there was two points that cut the straight line, and the rest of it didn't really fit. That's not even straight. I'm completely facetious here. Yeah, this is supposed to be, this is the theoretical curve is where these antiparticles are coming to you through the magnetic field of the galaxy, and so they're propagating things forward. And there's a belief that at low energies that's being complicated by what's going on in the sun. So they don't actually really believe that this is a disagreement here on the left-hand side. And what they point to is that there's more high-energy positrons. Rather, they believe that this part of the theoretical curve is one you should trust. That's essentially what's going on. So there's an excess, the message is that there's an excess of positrons, but there's also not an excess of antiprotons, is what that says. And so that's two observations. Now, if that's dark matter, and it doesn't have to be dark matter, but if it is, what's nice about it is that the way that could be dark matter is it could be annihilating and producing particles that you see. And what's nice about that is that the abundance of the dark matter itself normally comes to, is controlled by annihilations in the early universe. And so what you hope is that the annihilation rate that you need to account for this kind of a thing is the same annihilation rate that gave you the abundance that you liked for dark matter. And the bad news is it's not. That if you took the annihilation rate in the past, in the early universe that gave you the abundance of the dark matter in the first place, it's not quite enough to give you what they see here. So that's kind of the statement of what the observations were in cartoon form. On the theoretical side, what happened at the same time, and this is the PI contribution, basically at the same as the contemporary Nima Kani-Hamad, who's one of our DRCs, and Maxim Pospilov and collaborators, made the observation that people until that time thought about dark matter in a very simplistic way, that it was kind of the vanilla dark matter. It's some weakly interacting thing. It's like a W boson that doesn't decay. It has weak interactions. Bad example. Z boson that doesn't decay. It has weak interactions. It's kind of weak interaction-ish in mass, but it's stable, so it can be around for dark matter. And that's the kind of thing that can have the right abundance for dark matter. But these people made the observation that the dark matter sector doesn't need to be that simple. And a very plausible way in which you could, there's a very plausible structure it could have, which could account for those things that were seen in the experiment. So in particular, if the dark matter particles themselves were talking to the rest of us through the intermediary of another kind of a boson, which was comparatively light, say a GeV or so in mass, so similar to in mass to a proton, let's say, then that would have immediately some very robust consequences. It would mean that that the annihilation products would like to be dominated by electrons and positrons, and that's because what's really happening is the dark matter is annihilating into these new bosons, which are then decaying. But because they're so light, they can only decay into things that are lighter than they are, and that's essentially electrons. And so that's the reason you're not getting antiprotons, is that you've got a light thing that's decaying. It also, at the same time, because they're light, gives you a way of enhancing the annihilation cross-section now in galaxies relative to the annihilation cross-section in the past when the abundance of dark matter is being set, basically because the temperatures are different. It was hotter then. And so we're in a lower temperature environment where you're more sensitive to long-range forces, and the idea was that the attractiveness of this force is sufficient to enhance the cross-section at low energies in a way that would help explain the total rate. And so those two observations together, coming from a very simple, not such a crazy modification of dark matter sector, spawned a lot of activity because it drew attention to the idea that these kind of dark forces could exist, so things that are light that coupled to the dark sector and coupled to us. And so people immediately thought, well, let's go look for them, and realize that although there's nothing really stopping the technology in finding them, the bounds were quite weak, and that it suggested that there's really an experimental program that could be done with very little cost, which could constrain strongly the existence of these kind of forces. So in particular, at the Jefferson Lab, a bunch of experiments have been set up to do this. And in coupling constant versus mass space, you know, these are the existing bounds, and these are the proposed areas that will be excluded by these kind of experiments. And the green area is Maxime made the observation that one of those anomalies, you could do nice things for it if you lived in that area. But the main message is that there's a robust experimental program to cut into this parameter space that hadn't been cut into, and motivated by the observation that it could be relevant to dark matter. And so I put here that PI scientists, Philip and Natalia, are PIs for this. And the main message there is they're certainly, they are spokespeople for these experiments. I don't want you to have the impression that they wrote a paper saying, geez, you know, experimentalists should go look for this, and then the experimentalists went look for this. Natalia and Philip kind of basically went and slapped them around and went over to JLab and really initiated the process and are spokespeople for these experiments. And so that's the first example of one of the things I want to emphasize, is that amongst our faculty, Natalia, Philip, and Itai together, they are unusual even amongst phenomenological particle physicists, in that they really have a direct contact with experimentalists, which is not at the level of writing papers for them to read, but there's a really hands-on approach to how they interact and participate in the experimental program. Now, of course, there's many other ways you can look for these things, and we've been busy trying to find those things, and there's many other things that can give you these things, and we've been trying to find those things too. And there's a whole story there, which if someone asks, I can tell you about. The difference between italics and not italics is I tried to italicize all the PI-related people, and the other ones are not PI-related. That's the pattern there. All right, so that's the dark matter story. That was a kind of a big splash in the particle physics side. And then it's kind of timely because it comes at the same time as the LHC is coming online. And if it's true that the dark matter is weak-scale kind of particles, the information you learn on the dark matter side will inform how you think about the LHC side. Second topic was no-nonsense collider physics. And so that has two legs, one of which is aimed at many things. It's a program that our postdoc, Mike Trott, really has led. And the reason I'm describing it here is that he's really been a leader in this program, and he's brought with him many distinguished people, including our DRC, Mark Wise. There's not a couple papers here. There's really a program. And really, the program is, you know, the tendency of particle physicists is to kind of go swanning off and making up models that will describe any particular anomaly. And they're taking a much more systematic, hard-nosed approach to this and not taking the point of view that I'll try this model and then I'll find out that it contradicts something else later on, then I'll try this model. They're building a systematic class of models which build in from the get-go one of the main constraints on these models, which is flavor physics constraints. There's a lot of reactions that don't happen involving the changing of the character of the different kinds of quarks and leptons, which you can build in from the beginning and then explore what's the kind of physics that, subject to that constraint, so where you automatically agree with all these other experiments, could give you visible signals at the LHC, or could give you things that could explain these anomalies that have been seen. The trick is that the LHC, because they broke it, is starting off with less energy than it was supposed to have. And so the kinds of things that you're sensitive to early on in the game are things that are strongly interacting and tend to involve the gluons and the quarks. And the quarks strongly interacting new physics that starts to change the kinds of flavors that particles have are the ones that are strongly constrained. And so it's not at all clear that you could make models like that, but they've really been successful in developing a broad class of models in this framework. The second thing along these lines is a specific proposal for searches for new particles, and it's been championed mostly by Natalia and Philip. It's called simplified models, and the basic essence of it is that if you ever read papers written by the experimental collaborations, particularly in the past, explaining their searches for supersymmetric particles or for any specific kind of new particle, what's very annoying as a theorist is that they will typically do that in the context of some model, and it'll be some crappy old model that somebody made up 30 years ago, which experimentalists, being conservative people, take as being something that's worth spending their time on. But it's often not, as a theorist, the model that you would have really taken so seriously. And what's difficult to tell sometimes is to what extent the bounds being quoted are dependent on the details of those models rather than on just robust features like you're looking for a particle of a given mass in some sort of a coupling constant range. And so what Natalia and Philip did here was they systematized a way of presenting these bounds, which relies only on the kinematical, very few of the theoretical details, and so which is much more portable to your favorite application if you're a theorist and you think you have a theory that describes what's going on. And so they made this proposal, and of course, again, you might think they make the proposal and they send it off to the archive, and then all the experimentalists say, oh, what a great idea, we'll do this. Experimentalists don't work like that. They're very conservative people. And there's a lot of them in these collaborations, so changing the direction is like changing the direction of a Titanic. It's you have to have a good argument and a forceful personality, and you have to put them in a room and things get said before they'll do it. And it's a testament to Natalia and Philip that you don't want to be in a poker game with these guys. Natalia and Philip, I'm talking about. Oh, I probably copied them wrong when Philip sent them to me. You're right, they are. Yeah, they're so small you're not supposed to be able to read them, but you're right, they're all upside down. Good eyes. So what this slide is showing you, is that Philip and Natalia have been successful. That nowadays, Atlas and CMS, the two main collaborations, general purpose collaborations at the LHC, you know, they still will use crappy old models, but they present also their data in this more modern and more portable way. And that, I think, is a real accomplishment. It's not, people have been trying, have been telling experimentalists this for a long time. But the thing that made impact was having a useful alternative, which is practicable, which convinced them to do it. Precision cosmology. So here the example I want to focus on is Big Bang nucleosynthesis, on which Maxime and Joseph Pradler, one of our postdocs, have been really making an impact. And the impact. You would have thought the impact here is really that particle physics and cosmology both are mature fields, and people have thought about these problems a lot. And so it's not very often that you come across a new observation in these areas which is really changes how you think about them. And the example that I have in mind here for nucleosynthesis was the observation in these complicated dark matter models. There's often other particles in the dark matter sector, for example, in supersymmetry, and these other particles, although they may not be the dark matter, they can influence the dark matter's properties. And so there might be, for example, and there often is in many of these supersymmetric models, charged particles that are not stable but are metastable and decay into the dark matter particles. And that's often a part of parameter space in some specific supersymmetric models that's favored. The observation that Maxime made was that if these charged particles are around as they can be at the time that the nucleosynthesis happens, when the nuclei are forming from the protons and neutrons in the early universe, then they can actually bind to, the charged particles can bind to the nuclei. They're going to play a role that will change the nuclear physics and the atomic physics of the reactions that you're talking about. And the interesting thing is that many of the predictions in Big Bang nucleosynthesis rely on large cancellations, that in particular for things like lithium, the generic size of the cross-section is much bigger, or contributions to the cross-section is bigger than the answer. And so there's a delicate cancellation that happens to do with the selection rules of the nuclei involved, which get ruined if you start having other things in the nucleus that are charged that are changing the basic bound states that are around. And so the observation that these things are around and they can form bound states really changed in an important way how the distribution of elements would turn out. And so in particular, following that along, they found that they explored, it provides new bounds on these models. It also allows you to think differently about how some of these other lighter or more rarely produced nuclei, what their abundances are. And there's a problem, there's not a long-standing problem with the lithium abundance. And so they've looked at, explored various ways of explaining that lithium abundance. And the main message they find is that whatever you do for the lithium abundance tends to have implications for the beryllium abundance, which is something that you traditionally don't think you can say something useful about in nucleosynthesis. And so there's an observational window that wasn't there before, which is worth looking at because it has implications for beryllium. If you look at the beryllium abundance in non-standard explanations that are relevant for things like lithium abundance, the beryllium abundance also is important. And so there's an observational statement that can be made, which has some relevance, even though it's not something which is normally dealt with in the standard nucleosynthesis picture. So they've been invited to write reviews on this, and it's made an impact in this area of cosmology. Now, the fourth direction was the guidance from above direction. And here I'm going to need to give you a little bit of background again, because this takes us a little bit away from the previous lines of approach. The main theoretical guidance that you take from higher energy physics, which that could be here string theory, could be quantum gravity, could be just a grand unified theory. It's something of involving energies higher than the electroweak scale of hundreds of GeV or 1,000 GeV. The main thing that you use typically as theoretical guidance is that what you're looking at is a low energy limit of whatever the more fundamental thing is, and that has content to it. And to kind of get across the content idea, it's based on the statement that we know many hierarchies of nature. You know, the nature comes to us in hierarchies, and it's a basic fact of nature that those scales, different scales, decouple from one another. So you didn't need to understand, you know, nuclear physics in detail to understand atoms, and that's kind of why science progresses at some level. And that has a very precise statement. So the statement is, for atoms are bigger than nuclei. You don't need to know much about nuclear physics, but you do need to know some things. You need to know the charge and mass of the nucleus, for example, or the dipole moment, maybe, if it's got a dipole moment. And so it's useful to efficiently identify the things at long distances that depend on details of short distance physics. Because you want to avoid those if you want to make robust predictions and you don't know the short distances, or you want to exploit that and learn something about short distances if you are trying to say something and you think you know what the short distances are. So those are called hierarchy problems. And the basic observation is that the basic thing that constrains the theories at low energies is the statement that normally, if you have a hierarchy like nuclei being smaller than atoms, you can understand that hierarchy at any energy you choose to ask the question. So for example, if you want to know why are nuclei smaller than atoms, if your theory is the theory of electrons and protons and neutrons and interacting with photons, the answer is nuclei are small compared to atoms because the electron mass is small compared to the proton mass, and the electromagnetic interactions are weak. But if you ask that question at a more fundamental scale, where your degrees of freedom are quarks and gluons and electrons, say, then it still has an answer. The answer there is that the electrons are light compared to the QCD scale, and the electromagnetic interactions are weak. And the process of integrating out the quark and gluon physics to get the protons and neutrons doesn't ruin that answer. You have an answer before and after you did that integration. And that's something which we, in all the hierarchies we know in nature, is true, that you can understand at any given scale. And so an answer to why a hierarchy has the features it has, a successful explanation of that typically is expected now to have two parts. You first explain in the fundamental theory at small distances why it's true, and then you explain why it's true that the integrating out of small distance physics to get to the long distances where you do the experiments doesn't ruin your explanation. That second part is called technical naturalness, and it's something which, in all the examples of hierarchies that we know in nature, is satisfied, and so we demand it of our explanations of the hierarchies in nature that we don't understand. And in particular, the one that's relevant to particle physics is why the particle physics scales are so much smaller than the gravity scales, like the Planck mass. Why gravity is so weak is the question. And so, famously, the LHC was designed using theoretical ideas aimed at answering that problem. But that idea of naturalness has fallen into disrepute a little bit because there's another problem, the cosmological constant problem, the question of why the universe is so flat compared to the energy densities that we think quantum fluctuations would give us. And so the focus I'm going to talk about is aimed at, so there's a basic crisis of confidence in naturalness arguments that I'm describing. And I'm going to describe progress in understanding these issues. So now the setup part is that Freddy told you that string theory is an example of a higher energy theory, and it has objects besides strings, including brains, on which strings end. And the reason that I'm telling you that here is that that observation that you can have things localized on surfaces has had a lot of implications in understanding as to what the low energy limit of a theory looks like. When you have a naturalist problem, typically what you say is that at low energies, the most generic features are these, and that might be a big cosmological constant, and And what you don't like is the generic predictions are wrong observationally. And what you're looking for is a hidden assumption you made when you said that this is a generic prediction. The idea that particles could be localized on surfaces in extra dimensions has been very fruitful in identifying hidden assumptions that have been made. And one of the assumptions it identified was that we've always thought the gravity scale had to be quite high. But once you recognize that different particles can see different dimensions because some are stuck on surfaces and gravity is not, say, that opened up the possibility that the gravity scale could be as low as the experimental limits on it. And that always helps you with these naturalness problems because it means that the sensitivity to very high energies can be more than you thought it was because those high energies don't exist. That really the scales of physics are all very low. A second observation that came out of this kind of line of thought that has been historically useful is the observation that if you have these surfaces, they gravitate and they will change the extra dimensions in a non-homogeneous way. And then physics can depend on where you are in these extra dimensions. And in particular, the low energy physics can depend. And that happens because if you have the famous example is in the Randall-Sunder models, you have two surfaces on which particles are localized, and in between them, they back react onto the geometry by giving you basically a gravitational potential well, and then what's a low energy here depends on, what's a low energy depends on where you are in these extra dimensions. And so if you live at the right place in the extra dimensions, the low energy world is different than it would have been elsewhere. So back reaction there has been identified as an interesting and useful change, identifies useful assumptions that people made in these naturalness arguments. So now what is the research program I'm telling you about? The research program is based on the observation that this back reaction has been important, but it's only really explored in the literature in the case that there's one dimension transverse to these objects. And that's certainly not the generic situation. Generically, you have two or more dimensions that are transverse to these objects. And it's very rare that inferences based on one dimension will be reliably predicting what goes on in more than one dimension. And so there's a program at PI in understanding how this back reaction works and why it was, it's been difficult to do, and there's reasons why people didn't pursue it, but those are solvable problems, and they have been solved in some examples, including this next simplest example of two directions transverse to the sources. And the hope is that by understanding this back reaction, the same kind of things you learned and loved in understanding the back reaction in one dimension for naturalness issues, you'll find also new things. And there's actually evidence that that's happening. So the first evidence that that's happening is that it seems that, so the first examples, I think, of theories for which the cosmological quantum problem is solved are of this class. So there are examples here of objects for which there are two transverse dimensions. They curve the transverse dimensions, and then the low energy curvature that you see in cosmology is actually is much smaller than you would have inferred based on the energy on these sources. It's much like the geometry of a string. You can have a long, straight string where it's straight, so it's flat, but you can have lots of tension on the string, and the tension is curving the dimensions that are off the string, but not the dimensions that are on the string. And essentially, that idea is underlying the decoupling between the energy of quantum fluctuations of particles we know and the curvatures that we see in cosmology. And so what's special about that is that there are no alternatives that are known that are natural. And so this is very new work, and so it may be that there's a flaw in this that will be found. But I think that if you quote Sherlock Holmes, once you've crossed off all the things that don't work, what's left has to be true, even if it sounds crazy. It doesn't quite say it that way, but it's more or less the thrust of it. And so, in particular, the things that go into this mechanism are two transverse dimensions that are very large because the energies involved have to be comparable to the observed dark energy. And so if this is the way nature avoids the cosmological constant problem, and if you believe in naturalist arguments, this is the only thing that's on the table, then it means that there have to be two dimensions that are very large and supersymmetric, which has enormous implications for the LHC, for tests of gravity. There's many ways in which we'll know that this is right. If it's wrong, this is the last time you'll hear me talk about it. If it's right, you'll hear me every day remind you that I told you about it. And so it's an example of naturalist arguments taken to the point of being able to make to suggest things to look for in the experimental program. So where do we go from here? I'd like to close. So these slides were mostly made by Maxime, and he said rather than conclude, we should make an observation, which I've, because of that, called Pospisil's Law, in analogy with Moore's Law. Moore's Law says that the size of CPUs gets smaller every few years, or it halves every few years. So Pospisil's Law is that we find a new force every 38 plus or minus 2 years, and it's based on this inference that E&M was a kind of straightened out in 1860. The weak interactions were arguably discovered in the turn of the century. And if you think of the strong interactions as being found when the neutrons and the protons were differentiated and discovered through the strong interactions, that would be 35. The weak nuclear currents would be 73, and so these are spaced roughly by 38 years. And so that means that we're due. So we don't really have to do much. We just have to wait for it to happen. But whatever it is, we have to be all over it. And so
I think that we will. So thank you for your time.
May I miss the bottom line on beryllium 9? So is the conclusion that there are otherwise viable new physics solutions to the lithium problem which you can rule out because they overproduce beryllium 9?
I think here, so I got to defer to Joseph.
Could you maybe repeat the question? I couldn't hear it, sorry.
So I was asking what the conclusion is about beryllium 9. Is it that you can fix the lithium problem but it doesn't work because you overproduce beryllium 9?
So there are actually two things. So Cliff was mentioning a mechanism to lower the lithium 7 abundance, which at the same time dries up lithium 6 and can produce some quantities of beryllium 9. Now, this goes under the name of catalyzed Big Bang nucleosynthesis, where you have a charged particle, a heavy charged particle, which sticks around during BBN and captures the light elements, and thereby induces changes in the nuclear reactions. Now, this scenario is very special, but we also looked at different scenarios where you can produce beryllium 9, and they don't do anything to the lithium 7. So that they're really, it really depends on the model here. I mean, if you have a neutral particle which just decays during BBN and deposits energy, then you can actually produce beryllium 9, and you can use this as an indication that new physics happens during that epoch. Whereas it leaves mainly lithium 7 unchanged. But you can also have scenarios where you don't produce beryllium 9, but you still reduce lithium 7. So it's really somewhat of a model dependent statement.
So could you remind us what the experimental situation is with beryllium 9?
So beryllium 9, I mean, in the standard model in standard Big Bang nucleosynthesis, beryllium 9 comes out at a ridiculously small content. So it's like, in comparison to hydrogen, it's like 10 to the minus 18 or 19. Now, on the same time, you measure beryllium in the atmospheres of stars, and you infer it from the absorption lines. So going to very unevolved stars, so to stars with very small metallicity content, you can try to infer the primordial fraction of beryllium 9. And now the current best bound stands at 10 to the minus 14. So it's still four orders of magnitude away, but still the bound is very impressive. And so, for example, we found a model where it can produce beryllium 9 in excess of that. And so you're sensitive to a very large class of models, for example, which just deposit hadronic energy during the time of BBN. I mean, there's currently no beryllium 9 problem. There's a beryllium lithium 7 problem. But still, you can use beryllium 9 to probe physics, which is going on very early in the universe.
But I guess you have to worry about beryllium production in Hot 3 stars, right? Because you can produce beryllium supernova remnants.
Yeah, so.
Isolation.
Yes. So you have to go to low metallicities. And what you see actually in beryllium is a rising trend with metallicity, which is just a cosmic ray production.
Right, so I guess you have to track boron as well. Right, because the other production mechanisms gives you both beryllium and boron.
Yeah, so it's spallation of CNO nuclei, right, which produce lithium, beryllium, and boron. But going, picking those stars with a very low metallicity content, you can get a clue on what would be the primordial abundance or what is the limit on the primordial abundance.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of those stars, some of the stars recently that people found with very low metallicity are finding even lower lithium abundances.
Yes, that's right. That is actually a very interesting development in this field. It's just happened in the last 2 years or so. But this does not solve the lithium problem. It only makes it worse, actually. Because standard BBN overpredicts lithium by a factor of 3 with respect to the speed to the observationally inferred speed plateau. And now there's an indication that the stars actually drop off the speed plateau.
Right. So the speed plateau was important because it argued that it was not destroyed by, you know, during star formation. And the fact that you see such a low abundance probably requires some destruction mechanism. So that, you know, it seems more consistent with the protostellar phase. You know, that lithium is destroyed during the protostellar phase.
Yes.
Right? The stars are mostly convective and you bring the lithium down.
Yes, that's right. So
It seems, I think for many of us, the recent results on lithium suggest that the solution is not maybe astrophysical.
It's right. So that there's no final conclusion here. I mean, it's the stellar depletion mechanisms. They don't work too well to deplete very uniformly down to the speed plateau with very little scattering. This is what you observe. And so it's always worthwhile trying new physics, play around with that, and find other solutions. Just then, as with physical one.
Can you explain why co-dimension 2 works better than co-dimension 1 in the cosmos?
There's a sense in which I think it doesn't, in the sense I think people gave up on co-dimension 1 too early. And so so it depends on how much detail you want, but the important thing about low co-dimension is that I would say that co-dimension 2 is different than co-dimension 6, say, and that's because with the generic thing that's happening is the fields are falling off, and so for co-dimension 6, fields are falling off very quickly. And so typically, whatever you do in a localized region isn't really influencing the space around it very much. And what's special about co-dimension 1 and 2 is that the brains at one end, or a brain that's localized in co-dimension 2, or things are going logarithmically or growing in co-dimension 1. And so they really influence the bulk in an important way. And so the co-dimension 2 story of what's happening is that the tensions of the brains are being related to the curvatures surrounding them. And a cartoon of that would be, if you imagine a cosmic string, the tension on a string is giving you a conical singularity, and so that's like a delta function in the curvature.
Yes.
And so one way to see this cancellation that I'm talking about is that the Einstein action evaluated at that solution involves an integral over the curvature, and the delta function does the integral, and the coefficients in Einstein's equation such that they cancel. So the direct contribution of the tension is canceling the Einstein contribution that you get from it. And there's a similar kind of thing, people have made the observation that the similar kinds of things happen, but not in detail the same in co-dimension 1. But they stopped thinking about it because what they found was that in co-dimension 1, the back reaction is more or less a kink at the presence of the source. And so if you had one extra dimension that was a circle and they're often identified or something, so there's a boundary here. So you have, let's say, two boundaries. And if there's a kink up here, then the observation was that because you're in a circle, there had to be a kink down here somewhere to get the warp factor to be continuous around the circle. And so people stopped thinking about it because they said, well, this is a positive tension, this is a negative tension, and the reason you got a flat geometry was that you canceled them against each other, and that's fine tuning. And so there's an analog of this statement in co-dimension 2 as well. If you had a torus, say, and you stuck a source in here, then there's the statement that the order number of the torus is 0, says that the sum of the tensions plus the integral of the curvature is 0. And so if it's a torus, that's 0, so that sum of the tensions is not 0. And I think the reason that people stop too early is that, in this case, I know what's going on. If you actually, this is not an obstruction to a natural solution to the cosmological constant problem. If you ask, if I change one of these tensions by hand by some quantum fluctuation, what happens? You'll never ruin this statement because it's a statement of something equal to an integer. So it's stable under continuous changes. What happens is that you get curvature. So if you look at a simple solution like a torus, it'll look like you've lost your solution. But what happens is that if you change the tension, you start to get curved solutions. And so in these co-dimension 2 examples, half those solutions are known, and you can actually see what happens. And I suspect a similar thing happens here, although no one's really thought it through. So I don't know that it doesn't work in co-dimension 1. But I know that the things that they hit, you also have an analog in co-dimension 2, and they're not very similar.
Is the group here involved at all in the dark matter experiments, either Dhamma, Cogent, those people are talking to Fermi people?
Involved in the sense of that we are...
No, in the broad sense of it, you're very connected with LHC, right?
Yes.
But is there connections with the dark matter searchers, or are there events or conferences or things going on in that area?
Definitely, we're having one actually next week. So it's not as involved as the LHC in the sense that it's really unusual how Watai, Philip, and Natalia are involved in the LHC, because they're really slapping experimentals around and are in there. They could apply for experimental grants if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the interaction we have with the dark matter people is more of a traditional one, that very phenomenologically connected theorists are interpreting the data but not in the collaborations. They're not interacting like the level of someone in the collaboration, which is more along the model we have for the LHC. So it's very, 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 very much of a hands-on interest in the dark matter experiments, largely driven by the dark forces story, but that's really spawned in
right. Because there are some theorists who have gotten
pretty deeply involved in the analysis of the physical data or the experiments.
Yeah, who do you have in mind there?
Oh, you know, there are people like more astrophysical, like Doug Finkbinder.
Yeah.
You know, who really kind of push the data and push the field.
Yeah. I would say yes, but you know, if you want to step in to do well, then more in it, right?
So, as Cliff said, we're not involved with the actual data taking or the design analysis, but I think what we have been doing is using the data that is available and analyzing it in new ways and looking. So one thing that we are doing with Joseph right now is, for example, looking at very carefully at analysis of time series that are now coming out of those different experiments, because they have many more years now than they used to have, and it makes sense to start looking more carefully at the statistics of the time series. So, and this has been done in several occasions, and one thing that came out of it is more sophisticated analysis of the data. Another is suggestions for where else one can look at in the data that has traditionally not been looked at. Traditionally, there is a very particular part of the data that people are concentrating on, and all the effort is going there. And part of our role has been in suggesting new places to look.
Is it also fair to say that the experiment J-Lab that you guys are in grew out of the darknet business a few years ago? Right.
Well, I mean, the suggestion that there might be new particles that are underneath the Weak scale have been around for decades, but the anomalies that started coming out of the satellite experiments that people were interpreting for the dark matter, I think, triggered a resurgence of interest in that possibility. So those experiments certainly got off the ground with that motivation, but I think it's part of a series of questions that have been around.
And I think David's point is a good one, that there is as much room for a sort of close constructive interaction in terms of figuring out what some of the signals might be, that these experiments have been saying, seeing if they're not backgrounds, what could they be? They don't look like a traditional web. Honestly, I think we've all been thinking about it from the theoretical side, and that's where we're bottlenecked, just having some new ideas so that we can actually bring something constructive to the table. So once we make some theory progress, I hope we'll move in that direction.
On the same topic, what's the relationship with PI and SNOW? I mean, SNOW is very likely now to become the premier North American deep underground laboratory.
I would say, so I don't know if anyone else wants to jump in, but I would say we've been actually, you know, we have these various agreements with Triumph and CDC or Cambridge for exchanging people. We've talked to some of the SNOW Lab people about that too, and there's a general willingness to do it, but right now I think it's premature in the sense that they're not really, they're building experiments, but they're not, there's some, the Picassos are, for instance, running a SNOW Lab, but there's not a big program there yet. So I think there's a willingness to foster one, but it's not really ripe at this point.
I was interested in the visitor part of the story, but that was not mentioned in your talk. But
that's
mentioned as one of the highlights there. So you're asking the first two words, it's some little bit older, but what's the current bottom line? Or can one learn something about all of the subtleties of this inflationary?
You
model us by taking into account what you call a somewhat unexpected breakdown of some classical methods.
Yeah, I'm personally very excited about that. I think, and so there's two takes. I think one take is the community, there's two questions that people are asking. People are asking in inflation, how do I make precise predictions for what the fluctuations will be? But then there's a separate sub-community, and then the observation is that there are infrared divergences there, and what do you do with them? And I think that if you kind of pull the community, 98% of the community thinks that what's going on there is just essentially in accelerating expansion. You've got different Hubble volumes that are becoming causally disconnected, and so they're starting to fluctuate a lot. So if you do an expansion around a mean field, you're going to start getting a bad answer. And that's what you're seeing in these infrared divergences. That's more or less, I think, that would be my take on it. But there's a sub-part of the field that thinks that there's actually an intrinsically a gravity problem, that it's not really to do with matter in general, that the metric itself has fluctuations like that, and that would be some sort of a fundamental instability to the sitter space itself, rather than fluctuations of fields on the sitter space. And that's a minority opinion, but that's people are trying to argue, take the evidence from the calculations and apply it in both directions. So my take on it is that there's still no evidence that there's anything wrong with gravity, and that the infrared divergences you see for one, if you took a special case of one scalar field, there's an infrared divergence, but it's a pure gauge degree of freedom, and it's really the physical things from the metric don't see it. It's when you have many fields that you start to see these fluctuations and the infrared problems with them. But what's exciting with that is that even though it's true, I think that's going to be sorted out, and it's the large part, it's already probably sorted out at the level you need for observations. But what's conceptually interesting is the application of black holes, because in black holes there's a sense that there's an infrared information loss puzzle, and that and the puzzle at a kind of very nuts and bolts level is that you do a semi-classical calculation and you put yourself in the domain of validity of the semi-classical approximation, and then you infer that the entropy loss is whatever it is, and it seems odd that you're going to get portions of these various would seem to be odd alternatives, like you have to have a remnant, or there has to be violation of unitarity, or various things that seem crazy, but you seem to be being led there by what looks like a very reliable calculation. And I would bet money that what's going on is that people think that they're in the domain of a semi-classical approximation because they're thinking that the curvature is small, if you're not anywhere near the singularity of the black hole. And then so they design things that are nice slices that are nowhere near there. But if you actually look at where the problem in the black hole is happening, in the Penrose diagram, you don't want to be here because that's where the curvature is very large, but you do some nice slice like this that comes out, and then it joins onto something at out here, which is some time slice. The problem is in here, in the kind of the late time limit as the radiation's coming out. That's where the entropy problems are. And it's true that the fluctuations of fields on the horizon, if you put a black hole in an equilibrium with a heat bath, fluctuations are finite here, but if you take a black hole that's pristine and formed and evaporates, fluctuations tend to get large here. And I suspect there's a similar story to the Sigma story to be told about fluctuations near this horizon. And I think the way it should show up is that if you just do, forget deep issues about entropy, just do some boneheaded calculation here and look at the semi-classical approximation and ask our infrared divergences near the surface. This surface is becoming infinitely long here. So there's an infrared issue out here that you could worry about. And so I suspect the conceptually interesting application of the Sigma fluctuation story will be to black holes. But that's...
But it's not that you could already quantify this kind of zeroth order.
Not in a way I could defend in this room, but I think I probably could.
Anyone else?
But, so I have to talk to you later if you like.
Yeah. Okay, let's end this. The committee will retreat to its lair and we'll talk.